Full Service Radio is supported by Compass, the future of real estate in the Metro DC area and beyond. Discover more at compass.com.
You're tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
He makes an entrance.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, David and Nikki Nellis. Glad to have you back here with us. We've got a great show tonight.
Well, I think before you get into the show, for those of you who are tuning in to us...
How do you know what I was going to say? You don't know diddly squat.
I'm ahead of you. Okay, so for those of you who are tuning into us for the very first time, you may have heard us from our other show, our 10-year-old show, Foodie and the Beast, which is on 1500 AM.
We have a 10-year-old.
We have a lot of year-olds. But we've been covering the DC food and wine scene for, myself personally, for 15 years, but on our radio show for the last 10 years.
And I've been eating for decades.
You have been eating for
decades.
I have
lots of experience.
You do. But now you can talk about it. But here we are in the Gorgeous Line Hotel with our new show, Industry Night.
How can I talk about it if you're talking?
Okay. Or you could just be obnoxious.
All right. I could be obnoxious.
This could be a very long or short show.
This could be a long marriage.
Yes.
All right. So these are folks that we met on our other show, and we had an amazing time with them. John and Suki Jameson are the proprietors of Jameson Farm, and the one and only thing they do is raise the most delicious lamb you ever had in your life. Lamb and sheep, that's all they do all the time. And the story of their farm and how really their farming and their unique approach to farming intersects with fine dining and the history of fine dining in the Washington area is really a cool story. We're going to get to that. I probably should introduce this guy.
Yes, who wants your seat.
Get out of here. Todd Thrasher, mixologist of the stars, is here.
And soon distillery owner.
What's it called? Potomac Distillery?
Potomac Distilling Company.
Yeah, where'd you ever come up with that name?
Distilling Company.
Boy, clever name. Down at the wharf, you are going to be rolling in money pretty soon.
Killing it.
Yeah?
All right, come talk into my mic. That mic isn't working. Give everybody a little...
Just don't get too close to my wife.
Don't touch the mic, though. It's broken.
So today I brought a cocktail that's been with me for a very, very long time. It's probably the only cocktail of the old cocktails that are going to go to the new place. This is grog. It's a spiced rum, because I like spiced rum, lemon verbena tea, and lime juice, and that's it.
Simple, I think I saw that movie, I Am Grog. Is that right?
You starred in it, I think.
Okay, yeah.
So why is this drink so important to you that you would take it over to, is it here too, or just at the distillery?
No, it's at PX. It's been at PX since day one. It was the second cocktail I came up with at PX, and it's just like one of those ones that I kept trying to take off the menu.
Man, that's
and I
good.
Took it off the menu, and Whoa. People yelled at me, and so it's always going to be with me.
Now, can you talk about just a little bit about some of the rums you're going to be producing at the distillery?
So to start off, we're going to do four rums. We're going to do white, traditional white rum or silver rum, as we all know it, like, let's say, Bacardi. And then we're going to do a gold-style rum that we'll put in oak for a very little amount of time. And then we're going to do a traditional spiced rum like this one with no sugar at it. And then I'm going to do a new style of rum called the green spiced rum. And up on my rooftop, I have a garden of herbs. So we have lemon verbena, mint, lemongrass, lemon balm, and there's a few other things. We're going to put lavender in it also. But it's going to be a spice rum for gin lovers, for like gin and tonics, but this will be for rum and tonic.
Like super herbaceous.
Super herbaceous, yeah. It's going to, and I love gin and tonics. I love rum and tonics. A lot of people don't love gin because of the juniper, but this will be a rum that gin lovers will like it because it will have that reminiscent style of
this
gin.
Is...
And I'm going to make it like gin. I'm going to put all the botanicals in the gin basket, but I'm making it molasses based.
Interesting. Let me ask you, because... You know, rum has really changed over the last 10 years as far as how people are distilling it and how people are drinking it. It's no longer just a rum and coke. So which one of these rums, or is it all of your rums, are you seeing more of as a sipping rum, you know, something just to throw on the rocks? Would it be this one or the spiced one?
No. So all the four ones we're going to make, I'm making them specifically for cocktails. So every week we're going to make five runs on the still. So every week we're going to put one barrel away. So we'll take one out of the still, put it in a barrel. So every week we're going to put one barrel away. and that's how we're going to do it. So those rums that I'm putting away will be for more for sipping. For the ones at the beginning, it's all for cocktails.
Cool. All right. Well,
I have to say, I've had a couple of sips, and we could all be convicted of TUI, talking under the influence.
Oh my God, it's pretty good. Okay, opening date-ish?
September.
We can't wait. Potomac Distilling Company. Todd, thank you so much.
September 32nd? Is that? All right.
Bye.
So let's get on to John and Suki. Guys, unless you like are fifth generation sheep farmers, a lot of people we meet came to it from some other place and just got a couple of sheep, and the next thing they knew, they're feeling sheepish. Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. That's the end of it. No more.
Why was that joke bad?
That's it.
John, how did this all happen? Let's start from the start.
Let's start from the beginning.
The very beginning.
We have an hour.
1976. We got our first sheep.
Mm-hmm.
We found an old stone house in western Pennsylvania, had 65 acres with us. We wanted a house. We didn't want.
But what were you guys
acres.
Doing? I mean,
we were just living there. We had moved.
But you weren't farmers.
What kind of work were you
doing? No, we weren't.
No, he was in the coal business, and I had two children.
Mm-hmm.
And we moved to that
area. I'm sorry.
It gets worse.
We know.
Now we have three.
But what made you think, I want to buy sheep? Were you like, oh, we'll have some chickens, some sheep, a cow? Were you just like, oh, we'll just
somebody's
got to
mow the grass?
I mean, what were you thinking?
65 acres, what are we going to do with this?
Right.
And sheep were small, easy, I thought in my mind.
I was going to say, really?
Yeah, really?
Well, smaller than cattle.
Mm-hmm.
And elephants.
And we did it for a 4-H project for the children.
Okay.
And so I went through the 4-H program. Mm. And that's where I really learned about sheep.
Fascinating. So what were the first sheep that you got with the children? Was there a particular breed?
Southdowns.
They were called Southdowns, yes. They were small and easy to handle.
Mm-hmm.
And they like grass. That was the main thing.
And what was the goal? Right. But what was the goal like when you were showing them for 4-H?
That was for the meat.
It was for the meat.
That's the program in the 4-H program.
Okay, it was.
Yes.
So it was to raise them and then
you have
create product.
Right.
Okay.
It's like raising a tomato. You have a great product at the
end. Were you squeamish about it at the beginning?
No, I think because it's the process. You go through, it's a learning process, and the kids learn, and you learn, and it's that's the way it went.
And so then how did it go from a couple of sheep for the kids to...
A business.
We always liked cooking. I was doing catering and cooking, and we used some of our lamb and thought it was better than any other lamb we could get for what we were doing.
Now, is that because of the clover and everything that's out in the fields? I mean, was that just a stroke of luck? I mean, what made them better? Why are they better?
It was pretty much a stroke of luck. We didn't know the taste of lamb being affected by
terroir,
what they ate.
Right.
Yeah, at that time, we really didn't know. We were doing what Penn State said, and what Penn State said was have them on pasture, but use various grains. And then we found out after we started selling to a lot of chefs that they wanted grass lamb. At the same time, what was so interesting was we bought this farm in 76.
Yeah, we should say it's in Latrobe, Pennsylvania.
It's in Latrobe, Pennsylvania on the western edge of the Allegheny Mountains. Really, I should say the Appalachians. The whole run of the Appalachians were
here.
In the
we say
Western
the Appalachians,
but that's
you,
okay.
You really?
You're welcome to say Appalachians.
Well, she's from West Virginia. They all say Appalachian.
Okay. That just sounds so highfalutin.
I know she does.
The Appalachian Trail.
The Appalachian.
That's where Mark Sanford went hiking, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's
so
another show.
That's another show.
Go ahead.
Yes, but anyway, so what happened was in '74 we had the Arab oil embargo.
Mm-hmm.
And the Arab oil embargo caused the coal business to have a resurgence, which is why I got involved in it. But that's another story, too. But anyway, what happened was it pushed grain prices up because of the cost of petroleum. Chemicals, diesel fuel, everything went up.
Right.
So people started thinking about raising animals on grass again. At the same time, there was a guy named John Wall who came here from New Zealand. came to this country from New Zealand, and he wanted to start a fence company, and it was called Kiwi Fence.
So a guy named Wall wanted to build fences?
The Wall wanted to build a fence.
I think Donald Trump would like to meet him.
Okay.
That's good.
Bring me a wall.
I like that. Bring me a wall. That's right. Wall started a fence.
Bring me a shrub. Bring me a wall. Right.
But anyway, so what he wanted to do was he wanted to make the kind of fence like they use in New Zealand and Australia for grass production. And so he wanted what's called a high tensile wire that has a tensile strength that'll pull, right, mm-hmm. like this, kind of. And so when he came to Pittsburgh, he was looking around and went to U.S. Steel. And U.S. Steel was the only company in the country that would make this wire for him. And it's called Max 10 wire, M-A-X hyphen T-E-N.
So it's almost like elasticized steel?
Yeah, it is. You pull it. So what happens is you pull it, as my father-in-law always said when we said pull it, that's an American chicken. But anyway, when you pull it, it stretches, and you can stretch the fence. You can put the fence posts on a wider span, mm-hmm. thus making it less expensive right. to make the fence. You can electrify some of the wires and then do sub pastures, which is how all the grazing is now. We graze a lot of animals in a small area for a short period of time.
And then move them around?
And then move them. And that's called intensive rotational grazing, which was started by a guy named André Voisin in the 50s, a Frenchman. And so anyway...
But was that something that had been done in France, or was that a method used previously?
Yes, it had been used previously, but what his book, which is called Grass Productivity, mm-hmm. and his theory showed was he really boiled it down to a system. Mm-hmm. And so it made it so that people could do it. So now when you have grass-fed animals, in this area especially, Shenandoah, our area, they're all rotational the same way. And you can't do it without that kind of wire. So the wire started, the guy started the business about the same time we started our business. So we learned that very early. So we were doing that kind of rotation in the late 70s, where, like Joel Salatin, when you read about everything, he was doing chickens first mm-hmm. and with his moving things. And then later he started doing the other stuff. But we just happened to do it because we were there. Plus we were ex-hippie English majors, and so we thought that was much cooler than spraying everything with chemicals.
So, okay, so, but at this point, you're not planting certain grasses or anything for the lamb, right? You're just working with what's there.
No, and see, and what happens is, I have to jump in here and say this, is that what happens is with intense rotational grazing, you really don't seed anything.
Okay.
The animals go in.
The world seeds it, right.
Yeah, and they eat it down. Mm-hmm. And so they eat down the grass. The grass has been there. And if the pH is around 6, neutral, then what happens is they eat the grass down. That exposes legume, which in this case is white clover, which is naturally in the soil in our area. So since white clover is a legume like alfalfa or bird's foot trefoil, it fixes nitrogen from the air. So that puts more nitrogen back in the soil and grows more grass.
Yep.
And so you
so
just
it's a constant
keep rotating.
Cycle. So how many on your farm?
Yeah.
How many different rotations are there?
About 20. 20
22. Different plots?
Yeah.
And how many sheep are we talking about normally at any given time?
Well, like 400 or 500 in one at
wow.
one time, and then they're just moved all around. And so they actually our paddocks now are about 5 to 10 acres. They vary. And so they'll stay four days to 7 days. Where in the old days, we had 2-acre paddocks, and they would be in there for only 2 days and then move.
And then
well, now,
them.
People might imagine you out there with a big staff with a crook on the top trying to go, here, you know, sheepy, sheepy. But you have workers,
yeah,
four-legged workers on that
right.
farm that do all of it.
Right. We have border collies, and we couldn't do it without border collies. So we have three border collies. We have one that's really good at driving, pushing them. We have one that's really good at gathering. And we have another one that's young, who's kind of
figuring it out.
Yeah,
he's crazy. Had one that was good at going in circles.
Well, he does do that, actually. Yeah, he does a lot of that.
He likes to circle.
He's still kind of
hurting. He's hurting. Yeah. He's just not hurting who he should be hurting.
That's right. But it depends what we're doing. If I have a field with a lot out in the back that I need to gather, I have to decide whether I want to send my one female out to gather them, or if I put the male dog in the back of my UTV and go behind them and drive them. But either way, I get it done.
Well, so let's talk about the process. I mean, I feel like people should know first that you started this farm, you started selling lamb, and you hooked up with Jean-Louis.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So let's start there.
Let's talk
a little bit about your history with the chefs in the
Jean-Louis
D.C. market.
And who Jean-Louis is, because there will be people out there who are not going to know.
Okay, but
really,
I think they do, but David thinks they don't.
Well, that's
how many millennials you think have heard of Jean-Louis?
I think a lot of people, if they're into the food scene, then they know who Jean-Louis is.
No, they don't.
Okay. No, you're right. You're right, and it's sad that people don't. So
you got millennials that never heard of the Holocaust, so I doubt that they've heard of Jean-Louis Pelletier.
Okay.
Well, that's interesting and true. But
okay,
and,
so, go
so
ahead. That's why
Jean-Louis.
We always refer to him to keep his name alive. Yeah,
try to keep it going. Okay, you don't refer to him as the Holocaust.
No.
Jesus,
no. Our business was before. No, there's another story. But anyway, no. So what happened was actually was 30 years ago, Memorial Day. Memorial Day, 1988. He calls up on a Wednesday at the farm. And I didn't know who it was, and I couldn't understand who it was.
Because he was French.
He had a really
thick accent.
I want to say something to you.
He had a thick accent.
And he had a very, very low voice.
He was a smoker.
Like
that. Yeah.
Gravelly.
Oh, he was. Gravelly and low. And he said, "You change me son?" And I said, "Yes." And then we went from there. And when he was on the phone, I don't think I told you the story. When he was on the phone, I thought it was my father-in-law who was living in Cap Ferrat.
So he was messing with you?
I thought he was, and I was about to call him in Pittsburgh we'd call him a jagoff. And I was about to call him a jagoff, and then this guy starts saying, "And how long have the lambs been on the mummy? And are they still on the mummy?" And blah, blah, blah. And I said, "Well, this guy, I mean, nobody would ask that question unless he knew what he was
talking about."
He was a chef
or on drugs.
Exactly. Right. And with him.
On the mummy.
I like
the mummy.
That's right.
It's right up my alley.
Yes, right. Yeah. So anyway.
But how did he find out about you?
So what happened was we were signed up for a benefit in October of that year. And he was one of the chefs on the list. There were seven chefs that were cooking. And so, because he was one of the chefs on the list, I was told to send out a flyer about our farm.
But we should say he was a world-class Michelin-starred chef brought into the Watergate when the Watergate was in the process of kind of renewing itself after all the Watergate scandal in the 70s.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And he brought a level of, he brought a nouveau cuisine to Washington, and he called you. I mean, having him call you is like asking, you know, Babe Ruth calling to see if you make baseball bats.
Exactly. And see, I didn't know that. And so the next day after this happens, I would go on. But the next day after it happened, I called up the guy who was running this benefit. And I said, "Who is Jean-Louis Pelletier?" Mm-hmm. And he said, "The Watergate was going down the tubes because of Dickie Nixon." And so they brought this two-star.
Dick Nixon before he dicks you? Is that what the
right
was?
Anyway, so what? That's what we call him out there. But anyway, so what happened was he said that he was the youngest French chef ever to get two Michelin stars. He was 28 when he got two Michelin stars in the town of Condome, which he always loved to say, in Gascony. And that's where his restaurant was.
Right.
And so they brought him over here so that people would go to the Watergate.
Right.
Luckily for us, it also was a lost leader because there was no place in the country that he could get lamb like ours.
Sure.
Because he wanted 10, what he asked me for that night was he wanted 3 10-kilo milk lambs. So he wanted 3 22-pound lambs off of the mother, still on the mother. Wanted us to take them off and slaughter them and bring them down in 3 days. Two days for a
Friday.
Now,
was that something that you normally did or do?
No, okay. Never had no clue.
Imagine how shocked those lambs were.
Right.
The lambs were shocked, and Suki and I were shocked because we didn't know what he wanted. So, because he said, first of all, you couldn't understand him. Secondly, it's a totally different culture thing, because the main reason for having sheep in Southern Europe is for cheese. So the chefs there are used to taking lambs at that size when they pull them off the mother to milk the mother.
Sure.
Do you see, to make feta and Roquefort and Pecorino Romano.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was what Jean-Louis was used to. But we're these two hippie kids going back to nature and Pennsylvania English majors, and I'm clueless.
Yeah, what does an English major do with his degree? He raises sheep.
He raises sheep. Right. That's right. But anyway, so what happened was, we go down the on the Friday, and we have I have two 20-pound carcasses on my back, and Suki has one on hers, and we drive up to the water. Well, at this point, no, I'm telling it wrong. We're in the basement. I'll skip that part. So we're walking through the basement where G. Gordon Liddy was, and I'm just thinking about the plumbers and the whole thing. And we go in the back, and we open this door, and there's an alcove there outside, and it has a dumpster and a walk-in cooler freezer. And I knock on the door, and this is 10:30 on a Friday night because we got lost, and he gave us terrible directions.
Yeah, there was no
French.
There was no Waze back then.
There was what? No Waze. No, nothing.
No navigation.
Close.
No.
No, just Jean-Louis not talking well. And so we got. So I knock on the door, and the maitre d' comes out and says, "May I help you?" And I said, I was being cool, and I said, "I have trois agneaux for the chef." So, wait, you had walked in first, because I have two lambs like this.
Yeah, he thought you were wearing a shawl.
That's right, exactly.
Very.
And she gets in first, because she had one. Well, you helped open the door. And then, anyway, I'm walking through sideways like this, and one of the cooks takes a lamb off my back. And then there are about, I see what looks like about 20 white coats. And then this sea of white coats parts like the Red Sea, and Jean-Louis comes up and says, "May I take this from you?" and I thought, well, you know, this guy's famous chef and this and that. He'd be some old fogey, but he was a year older than I was. And 6'2 or 6'4 or whatever he was.
He was very tall and lanky.
Looked like Howard Stern.
He did. With
he's
that
tall
crazy
and, like,
Howard,
curly hair.
That curly hair, and he was wearing this is the 80s. So he's wearing Reeboks, Jordache jeans, and his chef's jacket. And he was very cool.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, he takes the lamb, and he takes it from me, and he goes out to a stainless steel work table. And these lambs were wrapped in white.
Now, they're slaughtered, right?
Yeah, yeah, these are carcasses.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah,
they're
let
lambs.
Me
yeah,
go.
Yeah.
But they haven't been butchered. He wanted to butcher
they're
them?
Whole.
They're whole.
No,
yeah. Okay. Okay.
I need some rum on that
they're
one. Anyway.
In.
Right.
So anyway, he goes over and he starts pulling off the wrapping. And he looks at the lamb. And he waves everybody in the kitchen over to him. And then he starts poking his head inside the carcass, inside the cavity. And he's looking at this, looking at that. He's speaking very, very rapidly in French and waving his hands and doing this and doing that. And I said to Suki, I said, "This is either very good or very bad. This is, what's going on." And then he waves us over to talk to him. And he's tearing up, and I'm going, "Well, oh God." And so he said, "You have to pardon me, because these remind me of the lambs I bought when I was an apprentice. This is a souvenir of my youth." And he was crying,
well,
very emotional.
Well, he was an artist.
But that must have been quite a moment for both
moment.
Of you, especially
Absolutely.
Since you sort of got in this. You didn't get into the farming for that.
No.
For that moment.
No, you were
know?
Probably thinking cha-ching.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there was kind of that. But it was just, but also I had never, what was the spiritual awakening, I guess, was that I didn't know that chefs ever knew that.
Oh, that they understood the product.
That they understood the product like that.
That makes sense. I mean, if you're not in it that way.
No.
And right?
And really, in the late 80s in America, to find a chef that would know that, I mean, he knew, this is what's amazing to me. Those lambs were 53 days old. And he said to me, he said, these lambs are 56 days old. And I said, no, chef, they're 53. And it went 3 days. Yeah, he was close within 3 days.
That's amazing.
Of how old those lambs were. Mm-hmm. And he said what they ate, how long they were with the mother, this and that, blah, blah, blah. And he could tell all that by looking at the, he looked at the kidney fat. He was looking at the kidney fat and the color of the meat, and it was amazing.
So after that moment, so here you have this incredible moment with one of the biggest chefs in the world at that time. And he was, I mean, listen, bringing that to D.C. at that time, working with incredible product, you know, just at that time, like in the mid-80s, late-80s, you had Larry Forgione up in New York.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? You had what was going on in California with Alice Waters. Like, you had some chefs really, you know, walking the walk when it came to local products and pristine products, you know, not just ordering from a Cisco or whatever it was back then.
Yeah.
So you have this moment with him, and how does that, and at that time, that's when the Chef's Club, that's a whole DC world where the older chefs used to all get together and do these big parties, Jeff Boobin, all of them.
Yeah.
And that's, is that, were you brought to a chef's club to introduce your product? Did he introduce you to other people? Like, how did you start working with chefs after that? What happened after that moment?
So the night that happened, he asked me, so after he's all excited and this and that, and we've decided he's going to buy from us. And he said to me, he said, so how big do you want to get? That was what he said. And I said, well, big enough that I could support my family, because right now, you know.
Right now I just got a couple of lambs.
You hippies disgust me.
That's right. It was one of those things. So what he did was he got us in touch with Gunnar Seeger, later Danielle, Jean-Georges.
Wow.
All these guys. He just called him up. He said, you will buy from him.
So, but let me ask you a question. So at what point do you get a did you have a distributor? Did you need a distributor at that point? Or were you able to do it on your own?
I mean, were you delivering these lambs in your car when you came down here?
Well, yeah, we did. We did that time. Because we had no way of shipping them in a box.
Did they sit in the back and go, are we there yet?
No. They're not alive.
I was terrified. So I have these three carcasses in the back, and we had gel packs all over them. And I said, my God, I'm going to poison three carcasses. Right.
As long as you made the sale, it doesn't matter.
That's right. It didn't matter. But no, what happened was, by that time, that was 88. And in 85, when we started the business, we started it as a mail order business.
Okay.
So we were shipping.
Were you packing in dry ice?
Yeah, we were packing in dry ice and gel packs in styrofoam box, and we were shipping UPS at that time, because 10 miles from our farm is a very big UPS center. So it worked very, very well for us starting the business.
Let me just, we have to take a break in 2 minutes, but I just want to ask, I mean, this is before the internet. This is before somebody could Google or order online. So how did you educate the public to this?
Direct mail.
Yeah.
Was it direct mail?
It was direct mail. That's what we did.
It
brochures.
Also radio.
Really?
Because we had some very good experiences on the radio, and that's how the word got out.
Better than this, Suki?
No, this is why it's natural for him to be on the radio.
Fascinating. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk more about the farm. And, you know, pasture raised is, you know, sort of a marketing buzz term these days when it comes to livestock, and sort of how you guys are leading the way on what's going on with farmed animals these days. Okay. This is David and Nikki Nellis. It's Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast.
Oh, you're smiling at me.
I know.
Yeah, I'm going to remember this.
Okay. And now that's over. We'll be back in just a minute.
The song you're listening to is Bring a Little Love by Keto. That's K-I-E-D-O. And if you tune in, you're listening to Full Service Radio.
All right, we're back on Industry Night with David and Nikki Nellis, Foodie and the Beast. Mm-hmm. I'm not the foodie, that's for sure.
That is.
We're talking to John and Suki Jameson of Jameson Farm. Not farms. We're going to explain the difference between farm and farms as well.
Well, why don't we just do that right now?
Well, they have a farm.
Well, you have because, but you know, for people who are going to farmers markets or farmer markets,
right?
You know, when they see something farms or farm, there's a big difference between the two words. Do you want to? One of you want to explain the difference? What the addition of
Come
an
on,
S means?
Sock it to us.
When we first started, the guy we were talking to about advertising this kind of thing, he wanted to do Jameson Farms, and I said, "Well, we're not a conglomerate. We're not going to be a conglomerate."
Yeah, but people don't realize
that Canoe's a big mass producer, doesn't it?
Yeah,
right. So we just said, "No, we're Jameson Farms."
Right.
And to this day, people still put an S on it, but
not us.
No,
we
not.
Don't. We That's don't. Good. We don't put an S.
But
on
people
it.
Don't realize that there is a difference when you add an S on it.
I think so.
Right, because my understanding is that when you add an S to farms, you're basically saying that you're more than you're not right. necessarily. You're not single vineyard, so to speak. Do you know what I mean? It's not
right.
just the one farm.
Well, that's right. And you're right. And
it
this
gives
is,
you an image of being so much bigger
right.
than you are.
Right, exactly.
So you're saying it makes an S out of you and me.
It makes an S out
of you
and me.
Don't
you.
Laugh at
that's
that, right. Steve. Don't help me.
Later, before the show ends, do we want to talk about your new book, On the Lamb, How to Escape from No. Something different.
Like, that's a good
that's
title.
There you
Maybe
go.
Maybe we need
that's,
to change it.
What do you think?
We have time.
That's what ex-history majors do. They go into marketing. Come on.
They do.
But okay, yes. So you start serving to you start selling to chefs.
Right.
This sort of changes your point of view.
But you go from nothing to you're rolling with the big guys. I mean,
right. Yeah. But as so over the years, you start doing different things. You start selling to chefs. You do go to farmers markets. You're at some farmers markets for a while. You don't do it now.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. We developed other because of the chefs. Mm-hmm. Using certain products, certain cuts of the lamb.
Right.
They didn't use the other cuts of the lamb. So here we are selling rack and saddle and all these glorious things to these fine chefs. What do you do with the rest of the lamb? Back then, in the 80s, Americans weren't eating much lamb.
No, the chefs wouldn't take the shoulders or shanks at that time. They do now like crazy.
Right.
But back then they wouldn't. So that's why we made the barley soup that we talked about. And mm-hmm. we made
I noticed you didn't bring any thanks.
Yeah. No, they did. Yeah, they did. Brought
oh,
it.
Oh, I noticed right you here. Brought some. Yeah.
Oh, my
right?
God. He's such a whiner.
He is a whiner. I didn't know that.
Please.
But anyway, Jean-Louis actually helped us with the first stew we made was was he and Suki made the recipe. He made the recipe, yeah, and he touched it.
That's like painting a picture with Picasso.
Oh, it was
amazing.
I mean, it's so delicious. It's so, like, on a rainy day, that's exactly what you want to eat.
That's the first thing I ate when I got
it's
home from
delicious.
The other show.
But so, so you do sell products.
We do sell products, but we make them ourselves.
You make them yourselves.
We have at our plant. We right. have a USDA plant, and well, we have an inspected kitchen.
That was
kitchen.
A big deal.
I was going to say, so how did you develop a plant? Was, I mean, why go that route? I mean, that's a major investment.
It was terrible financial deal. But anyway, but we had to do it. So what happened was, it was 1994. And so we'd been selling to Jean-Louis for, say, 6 years then. I think by that time he'd already gone to the Rio Suites now. He left here in 90, early
90s. Yeah, he was
90s.
Up in New York.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
When he went
got
to
sick.
New York, and then he went to Rio Suites. And then I think back to the city. Anyway, it doesn't matter. We were starting to sell to a lot of restaurants. And so we really wanted to be able to control the product all the way through. So in 94, there was a plant that we were using, and it became available. And so...
When you say a plant that you were using, you mean for slaughter?
Yeah.
Right?
We were using it for slaughter. And
then did they butcher it too, or did you... Where did the butchering happen?
No, they just... with that situation, this plant that we eventually bought was only doing slaughtering.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had to take the carcasses from there to another USDA... plant that would do the butchering of it. So it was very convoluted, and so we started looking for a plant, but then these people wanted out of the plant because they were sick and tired of dealing with the USDA, because mm-hmm. it's a lot of bureaucratic garbage.
Sure.
So, but we had no money.
Mm-hmm.
So luckily they were willing to hold the paper until we could find a bank that would finance it. So they wanted out of it so badly that they carried us for 5 years.
Wow.
And then we went to a bank and got it covered and did this and did that. But it allowed, we were the first farm, I think, to ever really have our own farm and also slaughter our own animals. So we've been doing it now for 20, 25 years.
Well, that has to be pretty life-changing for having that kind of control over the product. Oh, there's Roberta Donna.
Yeah,
you do see everybody when you're at the Line Hotel.
Do you want me to get him?
No,
it's gonna be fun.
Oh, go get him.
Do you
know Roberto Donna?
No, but I met him.
Oh, okay.
Because he's and Jean-Louis were friends.
Jean-Louis were big buddies.
Yeah. He's probably going upstairs.
He's with Bridget Bardot too. It's unbelievable.
Yeah,
he is right here.
But also, you know, I think nowadays there's a lot of talk, but I don't know how. But I don't think it's very accurate about whole animal butchering. You know, a lot of kitchens in D.C., in New York, California, maybe a little bit in the middle in Chicago, talk about doing whole animal butchering within their restaurants. But I would assume with lamb, it's very tough because...
It's very difficult.
A lot of people do not know all the different parts of lamb, you know?
Also, the cuts are so small.
Right.
So if you want to have... We get calls and say, I want 50 hind shanks. Oh, by the way, that's 25 lambs.
Right, exactly.
And they just don't understand. So what happens is, with this issue that you're talking about, is that people say, well, okay, we just want the whole lamb and we're going to do it ourselves. And I said, you realize that you're going to get two racks and that'll make you four portions, maybe,
if
you're lucky. So what happens on Saturday night when a party of eight come in and they all want racks?
Right.
Your SOL.
Sure.
And so what we do is from the start, we've cut it in pieces and sent it to the chefs. And they say, when we started, everything we did this way, I will say, when we started, we would send it to the chefs. And we cut differently than anybody else,
mm-hmm.
just because we did it based on what the chefs wanted.
Okay.
So if they wanted to cut this way, we would do it this way. And
well, let me ask a question.
Worked out fine.
What constitutes fresh? In other words, if you take a lamb and you cut it up into parts and pieces and it's refrigerated, how long can it be there and still be considered fresh? Because it's you're sort of at the nexus of, we're going to slaughter this lamb. Do we wait until we have a a customer for everything? I mean, how do you make that decision?
That's a game. That's a game you play. It's really a puzzle. It's a puzzle.
But, I mean, you know, you obviously have refrigeration, so how long can a piece stay in there and still be considered fresh?
So if it's – so here's how it works. So if we slaughter an animal tomorrow, tomorrow's Tuesday. So we Tuesday and then
– If it's Tuesday, it must be slaughter day.
It must be. Right. So if – well, let's say Friday because it makes it easier. If we slaughter on a Friday, they hang over the weekend. So then Monday – so they it's been 4 days since you've slaughtered them. So then Monday you cut them and you put them in vacuum bags. We vacuum pack
right.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the shelf life on a vacuum bag is 21 days.
Okay.
So we can keep it that long fresh. Now, most people use it. Many of the restaurants will use it within a week.
Of course.
But you never freeze 10 days. It, right?
Yeah, we do. Yeah, we do. Yeah. For the
especially
mail order
in
business.
The summer.
Right.
Well, what are you going
to
do with
yeah, I mean, I used to do work with Shady Brook Farms, and they, I mean, over the holidays, they would slaughter 80,000 turkeys in you know a week.
Yeah,
I mean it was unbelievable. It was like a death camp.
Mm-hmm. It is
but,
really gross.
But that bird would come off the line, and within about 11 minutes it would be done and packed and in a freezer already. Yeah. And then it was a question of how long before they got an order for it.
But so now that you're slaughtering and butchering your own animals and you're able to disperse it to the restaurants that need it,
right?
And people can still order.
Yes.
How are you educating the public on, I mean, I know there's lots of lamb events. That's how we met.
Right.
Lamb Jam.
Yeah.
But how, what's the education process for the public? I mean, you said yourself, like 20 years ago, nobody eating, ossobuco or lamb shanks or things of that nature. How are you educating them on the belly or the bacon or the lamb hot dogs we were talking about? I mean, how do you educate the public? Does it come from the chefs? Does it come from you? Is that what your book is addressing so that people eat more? Because there are other parts to eat.
Or are
there
people more adventurous and they're naturally gravitating to something that they like lamb and they
because I think lamb belly is delicious. It's
we do wonderful. Dinners at the farm and we do a lamb dinner and have people come.
I think we'll be dropping in around mealtime.
Okay.
But it's really all of the above. I think that people become much more sophisticated in their taste because of shows like yours and the Food Channel and all the just all the interest in all this. And that's why it was great that you were talking about Jean-Louis, because he was such a mover early on in moving that, and then unfortunately he never got to see the results of what his influence was.
Well, especially in D.C.
Yeah.
I mean, what's happened in D.C. today is a direct influence.
Directly.
Of, the kind of cooking he was doing here and many of the, now older chefs. I mean, we just saw Roberta Donna, but there's so many chefs who were acolytes of his. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And now, they're helming restaurants of their own. And while the cuisine has changed, the concepts have changed, the dedication to the product has become more and more important, especially in restaurants today.
It's important for the clients, too.
So. People are definitely more educated. Forget organic, but, I think if you said 20 years ago, our lamb is pasture-raised, most people would have been like,
So what?
Exactly. Isn't everybody's? Do you know what I mean? They didn't know, big ag and what's going on there. We haven't really touched on that. What is big ag like when it comes to lamb farming or sheep farming? I mean, what do they do? Is it as bad as cattle or pigs?
Well,
is it the same? Is there as much of it?
They have feedlots.
And so it's all the reason that Americans don't like lamb that much historically has been that the lamb is from the mountain states, Wyoming, Montana, California, and Texas too sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, those western states. Then after the lamb is weaned off the mother at usually 60 to 90 days, then those lambs automatically go to feedlots in the Midwest. And they're just force-fed grains.
With a lot
of corn.
Like pigs where they're kept in a little area and they're just eat.
Well, it's not a little box, but as I always say, in our front field we have 9 acres, and I'll have 300 lambs there for a week, and then I move them. In Greeley, Colorado, in 9 acres, they have 24,000 lambs.
Wow,
That's the difference. And they have a conveyor belt that comes out
right.
and feeds them the stuff, and they don't have enough roughage. And because they're ruminants, that's just not the way they were built.
They don't exercise because they don't have exercise. To walk around. Ours go up and down the hills all around.
So the meat becomes, it's too old when they slaughter them. Mm-hmm. And the meat is mushy because there's no texture to the muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have this cloying taste because the oil from the corn goes to the fat. And that's why people say lamb is greasy. Yes. But if you're raised on grass, you don't have that.
All right, so
that's very interesting.
Let's talk about the book, because we're getting close.
So the book is going to have, because you don't just sell your soup; you have other products,
right?
So how did you? So you sat with Jean-Louis, you made your soup, and how did you decide to? You started selling right away. Like, how did that happen?
We were Joan Hamburg in New York.
Mm-hmm.
They were at a fancy food show or some show, and they tried.
She was with Bert Green.
Bert Green. This was in, had to be the early
this
90s.
Was the 80s.
Or the 80s.
This was
okay.
the 80s.
And they talked about our soup, our stew on the radio.
Wow.
And it was illegal at that time. We didn't know.
Oh, because we were making it in your kitchen, right?
Yeah, we were making it in the kitchen. We sent it. We didn't know we were doing anything illegal.
Look at that. You didn't get busted, but you're going to go to jail for soup.
Yeah, I know.
So how did you add to the soup? Once you got certified or figured it out, did you add other products?
Yeah, so we have two stews, one soup, a lamb pie, a pot pie, which I brought here today.
Okay.
And three sausages.
Oh, fantastic.
So we make merguez.
Sure.
And we make spinach and feta, and we make a plain sausage.
Mm-hmm.
And we made the plain and the spinach and feta before we made the merguez.
Okay. And now, do restaurants feature those sausages as well?
Some restaurants buy a lot of merguez. They buy a lot of merguez.
It's a very popular sausage right now.
Ours is very, very good.
I have no doubt.
But
is Suki really going to say ours stinks?
No, I'm not. But I made we made the recipe ourselves, and a lot of the merguez you buy a packet or whatever you do. But all my sausages we made the spice mix ourselves.
So we really have to say, John, why did you make the merguez? So name droppy.
Yes.
What happened was we were at a food show, and Jacques Pepin was at the food show.
Mm-hmm.
And I was handing out samples of spinach and feta and plain, and he said, you have to make merguez. And I said, well, I don't know what it tastes like. I don't know anything. And he said, get Paula Wolford's book, and I got it, and I used that basic recipe.
Sure.
And then I sent samples to him, to Jean-Louis, to Gunnar Seeger, to Jean-Marie Lacroix in Philadelphia. And they also said, do this, too much this, do little that.
I'm very suspicious of you because I think you only befriend French guys so you can imitate their accent.
I do.
You're just sucking up
to all the French guys.
I love that. I mean, they really schooled you.
Oh yeah, they
to
helped.
Create that a fantastic. Was, yeah. I mean, you're so lucky. What talk about
We're
like
so lucky?
It was, it
you're
was
so
very lucky.
We are
right,
absolutely.
Like right place, right time.
It was great.
Mon Dieu, mon ami.
Tell us about the book.
The book.
What's it called?
Coyotes in the Pasture and Wolves at the Door.
Okay, I love that title. And what is the book about?
It's the story of our story mm-hmm. with recipes and pictures. The photographs are fabulous. Christopher Hersheimer's the photographer.
Okay.
And she did a fabulous...
With the wolves at the door, the tax
banks.
Man and the...
Yeah, exactly.
The banks that wanted to shut us down. The coyotes were what we had to deal with the animals.
It's not all funny.
We had a lot of... Yeah.
But
it's true story.
But we have a little time. Can we talk about having a farm and not being a big ag and
Wait,
how...
Wait, but you getting off the subject of the book?
No, it's in the book.
It
it's
is
that story.
Book.
That right. is right. the book. Were you
it's
not listening to what no, they said?
I only listen to myself.
I know. He only listens to himself. That's why he wears the headphones, so he can hear what he's saying.
Wait, are the rest of you talking? That's so great.
It's everything you hear about owning a small farm is how hard it is. And so financially, how is it that you can make it successful?
Well, that's really a lot of the story.
You need to focus on one thing. And oftentimes you see when people are starting out, they're just doing...
They're trying to do a lot.
Doing a lot at one time.
And right.
We just took it to heart that we had to do one thing and do it well. Mm-hmm. My father said, oh, do you want to do wool and all this and other that? And I said,
Well, but he said...
He also said you can buy a wool sweater for $20.
And he was right. He said, I can get a really good wool sweater at Brooks Brothers. This is in the 80s for $20. So why am I going to...
No, he couldn't. What? I was at Raleigh's in the 80s. There was no way he was getting a
wool. Okay, whatever. It's not your story. It's their story.
And not at Brooks Brothers.
Okay,
anyway.
But anyway. But you decided...
We wanted to focus on the food part of it.
Okay.
Because that's what we were interested in.
Sure.
And so that's...
But so was it, when you talk about the banks and the money,
yeah.
Was it getting them to back you up or support you or give you loans or like getting the USDA?
Or not beat the door down for the
right,
money.
Right.
Not beat the door down. We had to find different ways that the door wasn't beaten down.
Right.
It was always an issue because what happens with small business historically is that you can never get enough credit to survive long enough with business.
And then we'd get to a certain point, and then like the plant came along. And
right.
That
we
was just like a whole new step.
Right,
for
a whole
us.
Nother layer
yeah.
of
right.
money.
But exactly.
You guys were hippies. You remember Cheech and Chong. They would go, and you'd go, John's not here.
What are they?
They've moved.
Yes. There was a lot of that. There was a lot of that.
But now where you are today, I'm going to skip all the way to the end of the book, which
right.
is what I do anyway. I always read
right.
the last page first. So is it a success? Would you consider like where you are now at a good place as a small farmer in this market?
Yes, okay. I think so.
You
yes.
would. No, yes, she's right.
I said,
now,
what else do you want? We
right.
live in a beautiful farm in Western Pennsylvania.
Right, and
who
you're selling... magnificent product to some of the best chefs in the
yeah.
country.
Exactly. So
and,
what
and,
else do you
and
want?
And Yingling beer is made right down the street, right?
Yeah, it's not far away.
Well,
and,
there you go. So.
And actually, Rolling Rock was literally right down
right,
the street.
And then they got bought up. But
yeah,
I mean, you got beer, you got lamb, you got dogs,
yeah.
That's
you got
right.
mountains, and you got coyotes.
Right.
And also
be?
The first banana split was in Latrobe.
We're
having the banana
learn.
Split festival 2 weeks.
2 weeks?
Yeah.
Really? What's
they
the date of
every,
that?
The end of August, the 26th, I think.
Yeah.
What is the Banana Split Festival?
It's probably a festival with centered
yeah,
around.
I know, yeah. but like, what do they do? How does it work?
Eat they're a lot of banana splits.
They're celebrating downtown Latrobe.
Oh, okay. It just sounds like fun.
And Mr. Rogers is from there, Fred Rogers.
Oh, I didn't know
Mr.
that.
Mr. Rogers, Arnie
oh.
Palmer.
Wow.
Arnie Palmer.
The first banana
you got
split.
Any people that are still alive or no?
No.
No.
Arnie, you know.
Only us, you need to come.
Yeah, that's right. Arnie and Fred were in the
same
class,
high school
class.
So let me ask, because we're wrapping up the show
yes.
shortly, where can people in the D.C. market right now find your product on the menu?
Oh,
geez. Zaytinya.
Okay.
Zaytinya. Mm-hmm. Momo Fuku.
Mm-hmm.
And
Peter Paston's
restaurants.
Okay.
Obelisk and Two Amy's.
Well, Two Amy's is closed.
Eto.
Is it yeah. Closed? Two Amy's closed, yeah. They had a flood.
Yeah, they had a
oh,
flood.
Yeah,
oh,
that's
yeah,
right.
yeah, yeah,
they
yeah.
I didn't
flood.
Know if they were going to reopen. He told me that maybe not.
I heard that that was not happening.
Oh,
but that
sorry.
Doesn't mean I'm 100% right.
I don't know. Yeah. I just
I get lots
he told
of,
me that.
Lots
we
of people
too.
Tell me lots of things.
You don't sell to like Whole Foods and those guys because it's
no.
too...
No.
Yeah, so...
But people they, can order products
oh,
from
yeah,
you.
Oh, yeah, we sell directly.
Do we
on
go
our
to
website.
JamesonFarm.com?
That's right.
Look at that.
JamesonFarm.
No S.
Right. I don't want to make an S out of myself.
Don't make
right.
an
you
S
already
out
used
of yourself.
That already.
I know, but repetition is the essence of humor.
No.
It
when
is.
You say the joke once, you just don't do it again.
No.
Once is enough.
But I'd be dead if I had to do that. I can't think of everything.
And the book is coming out, hopefully, end of October.
Yes.
Right? And it'll be on
available.
Amazon.
It will be, but it will, and also from our website and from Word Association Publishers, he said
yeah,
directly
the
from
publisher
him.
Directly.
Okay, terrific. And will you be doing a bit of a book tour with that?
Yes.
Okay, great. So you'll
we
keep
will.
Us posted. And
absolutely.
Also your lamb dinners, I mean, can people, where do people find out about them? Is there a newsletter or some way to
website.
Stay up to date?
Do you do it at the farm?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
I
cool.
do a... I send out a constant contact blast.
Okay.
Every so often.
Okay,
whenever
great.
There's news at the farm. Or
can I ask you a question? How far
this?
Is Latrobe from D.C.?
Four hours.
Three and a half. I would say
depends
three.
Depends who's
half,
driving.
Four. Yeah.
Depends
on the traffic.
Driving, it's four.
It's four.
I'd be there at two and a half. We got to do that. That
I know.
Like
it's really easy. It's really. It's very close.
All right.
And it's, yeah, you should come. We have, the dinners are great. Suki cooks. We have guy from the plant, or Suki, break down lamb, show how we do it, how to French rack lamb,
cool.
Which you're never going to do, but at least you see somebody
do it. No, but you can
see
somebody
doing
it.
Yeah. Might.
And then I tell stories about all the crazy chefs. And
all right, but who has to do the dishes? That's my big concern.
David does the dishes. That's his
no,
job.
No.
David does the dishes.
No, it's not
David
because I want
job.
To.
You're there.
Because she makes me.
Right. Well, I do all the cooking.
Right.
He does the cleaning.
He should do
right,
the dishes.
I'm that's the king of the castle, the lord of the manse.
Who but, cleans the kitchen after great. The lady of the manor cooks the dinner. That's what happens in our house.
That's right. Sir, yes, sir.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So,
all right.
Well, let's just do it once more. So it's Jamison, JamisonFarm.com, and it is lamb to die for.
Thank
yes.
you.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. And definitely order the barley soup because it's really, I mean, I make my own soups, but it's delicious. It's really lovely.
It's made with our own lamb stock. That's why it's so
oh,
good.
Oh, that's why it's
I'm
so
good. I'm particularly
good.
Fond of lamb ribs, I have to say.
They're great.
The best, man. They
but, see, now, there's another product. I know we're wrapping up the show, but there's another product 10 years ago you didn't see anywhere.
Right.
And now
right.
Tail Up Goat around the corner serves a big platter of a bunch of lamb ribs on top of each other, and it's super delicious.
It's great.
Yeah, so
you know
it
what?
Is great.
He who shall not be named had him at a roast.
Yes,
too.
It's
yeah,
not a at a roast. Yeah, at a roast he did, but
so,
we can't talk about him.
No,
not it right now.
A bad boy.
Not yet.
All right, so guys, thanks.
Yeah, so
thank
we want to
thank you so much.
We want to thank everybody for tuning in today to Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. We had a delicious meal as usual. We're off for a couple weeks. When we come back, we'll have something just as yummy waiting for you.
Waiting for me?
Well, not you.
Oh, you're looking at
me.
We're
listening. Because you're standing there. Okay, let's wrap it up. Have
get me out of here.
Have a
save
delicious
me.
Week.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.